Dr. Kneipp earned her Bachelor of Science in Nursing and a Master of Science in Community Health Nursing from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. She received a PhD in Nursing Science from the University of Washington in Seattle. She's currently an Associate Professor in the School of Nursing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her program of research focuses on the social policy and economic determinants that impact the health of disadvantaged populations, particularly in relation to welfare policy, employment, and women's health. Her studies have applied a community-based participatory research, CBPR approach, to develop and test a public health nurse case management intervention for women as they transition from welfare into employment, which resulted in positive health and employment entry gains. Her current research builds on the findings from that work to examine intersections between health and employment for disadvantaged groups. It remains grounded in community-engaged methods and is supported by the NIH and the CDC. Dr. Kneipp is going to speak to us on challenges in studying women's health disparities.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I know it's post-lunch, so hang in there. What I'm going to talk to you about today is really a journey. And so rather than talking to you about the specifics of the research design or any findings, what I'm going to do is walk you through this two-year journey that we had in building this transdisciplinary research team and get into the literature a little bit in terms of differentiating transdisciplinary from interdisciplinary and other forms of team science kind of work. So here's my disclosure. I have nothing to disclose. And this was previously actually the title of this talk because I think it sums up very well what building this team science relationship was like, strange bedfellows who speak in tongues. That's how we all felt. We were in very different disciplinary, we had come from different traditions, we had entirely different languages, we had different plans for how we envisioned this research project to take hold. And so we had a lot of work to do to bring those together. I just want to acknowledge all of the supports at UNC Chapel Hill that have really helped shepherd this work along the way. I think when you do transdisciplinary work like this, it can be really grueling. All research is grueling, but this is tough to do, and you need support and encouragement along the way to have a belief in creativity, I think, and I felt like I had really gotten that over the last 2 years. So lots of these organizations or departments at UNC really helped that come along. And I should mention also that this, so ultimately this is the road to having the R21 funded through NIMHD. So this is sort of the cast of characters, if you will, and we have folks in the middle who are on the team from UNC. And so there's myself, Donna Galeski, who is an economist at UNC Chapel Hill, Todd Schwartz, who is a biostatistician. On the lower right-hand corner is Robert Gilmore, who has been my community partner for a very long time at the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families office or the Welfare to Work office. And up in the top right, we're new partners. We brought into the team Daryl Atkinson and Whitney Fairbanks, who are lawyers. And Daryl continues with us. Whitney has moved on into a separate position. But Daryl is at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. And so he's done a lot of wonderful work, and I think he will be instrumental in taking the findings out into the community and doing something with them for policymaking. And then Amanda Sheely in the upper left-hand corner, she is at the London School of Economics. Amanda is she is an expert in social policy and social welfare policy, and so she's on the team as well. So this will just help you kind of keep in mind some of the storytelling, who the players are in the storytelling. So when you dig into the literature, there's a nomenclature for collaborative research. But most of the time when we read the literature, we kind of gloss over all of that and call everything interdisciplinary. But really, it's not all the same. There are fairly important distinctions for the different terminology that you might use that really have an impact on the ability of the science to shift the paradigm. And so there are three, essentially, terms that are in the literature. One is multidisciplinary, and that's a very basic form of work within or across disciplines, I guess, where members really work independently and sequentially, but they don't integrate anything. There's nothing that's really synthesized. They just do their own piece, and then someone puts it together like a puzzle in the end. Interdisciplinary work, where members do add perspectives, but they don't really integrate their perspectives. There's nothing new that's formed from them, necessarily. And transdisciplinary work comes when teams fully, or members of teams fully integrate or synthesize concepts, theories, and or methods. And if you're interested, this attention to this was really paid in the early 1990s by Rosenfield. There's a seminal article about this where she had observed research teams working and had correlated some of that with the findings from the research and the impact from the research. It's a really great article if you're interested. And then there have been some nursing science-focused articles, too, trying to trace the lineage of the use of these approaches throughout nursing. So Rosenfield's paper basically found, or her observations found, that models of scientific collaboration differ by the level of theoretical and methodological integration within teams. And the academic, career, and social and health outcomes from the research actually vary based on the level of integration. And so that seminal work actually launched a lot of what was to become the NIH roadmap and many of the initiatives within the National Science Foundation to encourage transdisciplinary work. We hear about team science now all the time, and this was really some of that seminal work that launched that. So 10 years later, what's happened? Team science, and specifically transdisciplinary work, what we have learned over the last decade is that it's really fraught with challenges, it's inevitably conflict-laden, and it's extremely labor-intensive. And none of these things, let me just say, bode very well for its future, because it's very tough to do. But you know, there's a rainbow and a pot of gold at the end, so just stay tuned for that. And yet, despite all of those things, it's also true that that type of work is the most likely to lead to paradigm shifts that Kuhn proposed are needed to make the most significant scientific discoveries. So that sort of gave me hope. This is a very realistic timeline of the development of this team, and if I can, the mouse is sort of semi-cooperating here, but if I can trace for you, I mean, we really started this work in 2012, and so there, all of these events were really team-building kinds of things. I'll tell you the story of how this got started very accidentally. When I was doing some pilot work with my community partners, brought in Amanda, who is the social policy expert and who I had worked with, and we talked about what we thought we were seeing or what any of this meant. Did a lot of work in between in terms of a fairly extensive literature review, synthesized the findings. I'll show you how we approached that a little in a few slides, and and found, yeah, that there really is some legitimate basis to what we think we want to study. Brought in the legal expertise. We wrote a couple of grants in between, did not get them funded, learned some things from that, and revised the grant, and had a couple of manuscripts accepted along the way that described what we wanted to do, and then finally had it funded. So that's for those of you in the room who don't routinely do this, that's a pretty typical longitudinal trajectory, I think, of how long it takes to get from idea to funding. So the origins of this really started from the community-based participatory work that I do. I was working with my community partner in the Work First program. I was in the process of doing a very small pilot study to look at how to integrate problem-solving training into an intervention that I had previously tested and had fairly good outcomes, but I thought that this could bolster that. And as we were doing that, one of the objectives of problem-solving training, so this is for women who are in the Work First program or the Welfare to Work program, was really the first step in doing this training is to have them identify and prioritize problems that they thought were interfering with optimal health and functioning. So as we were working through this, and I knew this in the back of my mind, I had had this come up before, but it was a moment, it was one of those epiphany kinds of moments when I was doing the problem-solving training and two of the six participants talked about a criminal record as their top priority. And two out of six, this is something fairly significant, and when I asked them more about that, they clearly walked me through the pathway of what it meant to have a criminal record history and how that leads to stress and how that deteriorates health, typically through their inability to obtain employment. So they drew the model for me and showed us how this all works. So when we talked further, you know, the types of crimes they were talking about, these were not crimes, felony-type crimes, necessarily. Many of these crimes were misdemeanors. Things that I would come to learn later are probably best described as crimes of poverty, financial survival types of crimes, non-payment for bad checks, things of that nature would turn into a misdemeanor. And then once that's on their record, actually trying to find a job becomes very tough. So we set out, Amanda and I set out to see if what's this like in the literature? What do we even know about this? What do we know about these pathways of social determinants? And the top model here is what I wanted to test. This is what we were looking for, is does having this criminal record history influence TANF, which is the group that I had been working with, and the access to that and receipt, which intersects with employment. And in a very basic way, TANF, if you're enrolled in a TANF program, there are pros and cons to that. Lots of cons, one pro is that if you're in a network, a program that has strong social tie networks out to employers, for example, my community partner, he has a network with employers where he can say, you know, I have a few people with criminal record backgrounds. Can we get over that? Can we work through that so that you can hire folks? So that's a benefit of actually trying to find a job through that program. There are direct effects, I thought, of having a criminal record history on employment status, and then there are ways in which the TANF program sort of moderates that. And then employment has a clear and strong consistent relationship with health across the way. So that's what we were looking for in the literature. You know, did anybody really test this model? How much do we know about this? And these are the kinds of relationships that we found in the literature. Basically, lots and lots of studies looking at criminal history, incarceration only, looking at that as an employment barrier, looking at, again, largely incarceration, but those aren't necessarily the crimes we were talking about or the sentences that we were talking about. Criminal history, how does that lead to health status, and is it an employment barrier? And then there were a whole group of studies that looked at whether TANF receipt was related to later on having a criminal history and health status, and whether those then became employment barriers. So lots of different relationships, but none really honed in on this model that we wanted to test. So like every good academic, we went to lunch. And I talked about this with Amanda, whose picture somehow came off of there, and Donna. And we talked about how we could study this. What were the aims that we, you know, we carved out the aims that we were interested in. Largely, we had a descriptive aim, just wanting to know the prevalence in this group of criminal record. That's actually not out there. There's very little that's known about that. A second aim that really wanted to look at the relationship between a criminal record and health, but again, looking at how employment mediates that along the way. And then we also wanted to look at whether that mediated relationship is affected by whether women are in TANF or not, or whether they're receiving TANF services or not. So we had several conversations. Donna is coming from an economic background, and that is a very different analytic background. I thought only analytic background was different, not than what we had come from. So we had several conversations about the type of kinds of modeling that we wanted to use, but it was really difficult to get across the language. And so, for example, she would talk about addressing unobserved variables and joint estimation, and I would talk about confounding variables. And she had no idea what I was talking about, and I had no idea what she was talking about when she talked about unobserved heterogeneity. So there was this huge dissonance there. But one of the things that the type of analysis that she does would allow us to do is forecast or simulate. For example, if we had a good data set, and we do now, we could forecast if we made one change in policy that got 10% more women jobs, what would that look like 9 years later on their health outcomes? And so that was really appealing. Some of the leadership tasks that I had to take on were cognitive, structural, and process related. And so my job as the PI, or the leader of this team, was really to manage meaning and to keep in mind how our diverse perspectives would really be a strength and overcome some of the frustration that people were feeling with not being able to communicate. I acted as a broker and really ameliorated power and status differentials. And then later on in the path or the journey, there were some process-related things that I had to attend to in terms of, you know, when we had rejections and successes and sort of regulating all of that and making sure that that wasn't enough to hamper the team sticking it out. So we went to lunch again and talked about it. And this is how the economist talks to us. And so that's what I mean. So we would say, but what about this? And she'd say, I can tell you exactly what that means. Let me show you. And that's what she would show us. And I would be like, well, Donna, that's great, but, you know, I just don't know what this means. And so lots of conversations, and we responded. I'm going to speed up a little bit. We're behind time. We responded to a couple RFAs, And this was, I think this is a great summary statement of what we were, what any transdisciplinary team tries to do. Not, the difficulty is really in escaping the old ideas. And if you can get past that, there's a lot in store for you. We also had some theoretical challenges. So for example, most of you, when you learn how to write a research proposal, you draw a model and you have a theory that is related to that model, and it shows people the relationships between the concepts, right? Well, in economics, apparently there's a built-in theory that one must use, and I did not know this. And so we had a lot of work to do to integrate economic theory and social determinants of health theory. And trust me, they initially seemed like complete opposite, polar opposite ideologies, but we got there. And in fact, there are a lot of similarities, but we had to write about that in the proposal. So this is what her model looks like, plus a health science model looks like. Our model would just have, you know, our variables of interest and maybe the measures that we were going to use, but her model has to actually include the equations in there. And so, and capture this whole dynamic component of the kinds of analysis that we're going to do. But neither one of us really knew how to do that. So had it, sent it in, rejected, had some very good reviewer feedback about what we did right in terms of forging a workable research collaboration. I just think this quote is actually hysterical from one of the NSF reviewers. Like, surprisingly, we're not sure how they did this, but they forged a really workable research collaboration. And yet, we still got the analysis part all wrong because no one could understand it. So we had a lot more work to do. One of the classes that I was teaching at the time is a theory class for the PhD students. And one of the students laughed one day and said, what you don't want is to propose a vortex of a model, because then you can't work out what the relationships are. And at that moment, I said, oh my gosh, that's what we've done. You know, we've submitted the vortex model. And what we really needed to do was break down these relationships. And so this is part of an additional model that went in the second time that we submitted it, so we could show them exactly which pathways we were testing, as opposed to this thing that just keeps going around and around and around, even though that captures the dynamic portion. So I'm way over time, this was a great quote, too. The characteristics of the team members, and we had this across all of the team members, rigor, openness, and tolerance will let you kind of get through, and the science will carry the day. So again, those are the activities, all of the things that we really did to get to that place. Transdisciplinary work is inherently different and a little more difficult, but we just have started. We had our first full team meeting on Friday and looked at the data, and it's really going to be exciting to be able to publish the findings and really think about, it's really truly a social determinants of health model. What is it that's driving health that, you know, we can look at over time? So we're really excited about it. But.